This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest was part of President Obama's inner circle at the White House, but she is not famous. In fact, in 2011, she was included on the New Republic's list of Washington's most powerful, least famous people. But now, her name, Alyssa Mastromonaco, is becoming a little better known with the publication of her new memoir, which is a bestseller. It's called Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? It's not an expose. It's about what it takes to make things work at the White House and how stressful the process is. Mastromonaco was assistant to the president and director of scheduling and advance at the White House from 2009 to 2011, then served as assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014. She started working for Obama in 2005 when he was in the Illinois Senate and running for U.S. Senate. Before that, she worked for John Kerry and served as his director of scheduling during the 2004 presidential campaign. She's now an executive at A&E Networks and a contributing editor at Marie Claire. Alyssa Mastromonaco, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what your job descriptions were as chief of staff for operations and then the position that you held before that.
Well, as deputy chief for operations, I oversaw everything from the research, selection, nomination, interview process, a confirmation process for cabinet secretaries and political appointees across the administration. I oversaw the White House military office, which is about 3,000 mostly military members that ran Camp David, oversaw the maintenance and operation of Air Force One and Marine One, the scheduling and advance operation, which I had previously run before becoming deputy chief, which oversees the president's daily schedule, his long-term schedule, foreign travel, negotiates with foreign governments when we're traveling abroad, and basically anything involving the First Family and Secret Service.
Whoa. That's really, that is some job description. And before that, you were doing scheduling in advance for President Obama.
That's correct. I was the director of scheduling in advance on the 2008 campaign and then for the first 2 years in the White House.
Okay, so by this point in President Obama's presidency, and I just read this in the New York Times, President Obama had made public appearances in 9 states, took 3 overseas trips, and was beginning his 4th journey abroad. And you were organizing all of that?
We were.
So what stands out from that first less than 100 days of President Obama's presidency in terms of your job?
So I think for me, you know, on the campaign, you get used to a certain rhythm. You work with the same people. And this was a total reacclimation. You have far fewer resources than you would actually imagine. One thing people don't know is that the president's travel budget is not unlimited. And when we would travel to those 9 states for official events, you actually have to work with all of the cabinet secretaries to figure out who is going to sponsor the trip. So is the trip about agriculture? Is it about education? So that was actually something that we never expected that was quite hard because you basically become an internal fundraiser with the agencies. And planning the foreign trips, you know, we took the lead basically from folks at the State Department who had been there for many years and knew how to execute a flawless trip. They taught us what we needed to know. And we sort of also followed the lead of the White House military aide to the president. Everybody knows that's the person who carries the football. But they also transition, you know, their rotations transition from administration to administration. So one of our first mil aides that helped us was actually had been with President Bush for a long time. So one of the things that I think about when I see President Trump and his administration is that I hope that they are taking the time to learn the lessons that we did. It's a very humbling experience, those first 100 days. Everything that you think you know is sort of turned on its head. So for us, we were running pretty fast those first 100 days, but we laugh because when we look back, the first day the president was in the Oval, that whole day before, when we were trying to prepare his day, you would have thought that we were sending him into a war zone. We were sweating so hard. When really, when we look back on that schedule, it was 3 meetings, 2 of which were in the Situation Room. So it is a very different beast.
So when you look at President Trump's travel schedule, which, you know, he's been to several states, no trips overseas, but is constantly going back on weekends to Mar-a-Lago. You said the travel budget for the president is not unlimited. So what do you think his travel budget is like now? What do you think traveling back and forth to Mar-a-Lago most weeks is costing?
So what I actually read last week, which was very shocking, is that currently President Trump is on track to spend in 1 year what the Obamas spent in 8 years on personal travel.
So is personal travel a separate expense line in the budget?
Yes. Personal travel, there is not an actual budget for personal travel. You just try to keep it as low as you can. You know, President Bush would go home to Crawford, and that was pretty standard. They had a real way of operating. But one thing that people forget when they try to compare the Trump trips to the Bush trips is that every president gets a secondary residence. So they live in the White House, but for the Obamas, it was Chicago. And for President Bush, it was Crawford. And for President Trump, it's actually New York City, which is why those trips to Florida are so expensive. Because when President Obama or President Bush went to their homes, their infrastructure to protect them and support them was there, and it stayed there, so it wasn't a constant expense. So, you know, President Trump is someone who criticized President Obama for driving down the street to Andrews Air Force Base to play golf on the weekends. I would love to know how he justifies this as somewhat different.
So, since you had so much of a role in finding and selecting people for cabinet positions and other positions, what are some of your reflections watching the selection process for President Trump's cabinet?
Well, you know, I look at it and I just remember how much thought and vetting went into the folks that we were selecting. And I think that there was one moment that struck me when he was talking about nominating Steve Mnuchin to Treasury Secretary and how he should be given the same speedy confirmation that Tim Geithner was. And people may recall that Tim Geithner was the chair of the New York Federal Reserve, which I think is a much more translatable skill set, let's say, than having been an executive at Goldman Sachs. And so I think that, you know, the president didn't seek out, President Obama, rather, didn't seek out people who singularly agreed with him. He did go for sort of a team of rivals or, you know, differing perspectives and thoughts because he wanted to be the president of all of the citizens of the United States of America, not just the Democrats. And so, one, I think that the Trump folks, I mean, we moved deliberately, but we moved quickly. And so many agencies right now are home alone, no deputy secretaries, things that cannot be blamed on Congress because they haven't even nominated people. No deputy secretary of state, you know, no people at the State Department at all, practically. So I would hope that they would focus a little bit more on what it takes to make the government work and then criticize the government for being slow. But right now, I don't think that they have a fair or accurate representation of what the government actually does because there's no one there to do the work.
Can you translate for us practically what it means to not have a deputy secretary of state and to have a lot of positions open in the State Department?
Sure. So one thing, like, for example, something that people have not talked about that much, but during the Obama administration, the State Department did daily press briefings. And those briefings were the way that Foreign Service officers all around the world got their information. Well, those haven't been happening. So Foreign Service officers are being sort of cut out of the loop in the countries where they work because people know they don't have information. Having a Deputy Secretary of State, you know, if you look at Secretary Clinton or Secretary Kerry, they travel all the time. So the two deputy secretaries really help run the agencies, whether it's for policy, like the policy process or, you know, resources and management. And so to not have anybody doing that, then all the people below have no guidance. And those positions haven't been filled. And there's a distrust, you know, that isn't something I'm making up. It's something that the Trump folks have stated, this mistrust for the career employees who are actually the people that carry us from administration to administration with depth of knowledge and institutional knowledge. And so I can't imagine, for example, if President Obama were having a meeting in the Situation Room on Iraq, there would be a process at DOD, at, you know, DOJ, at the State Department, that went down into all the various levels of expertise, so that what was ultimately served up in the Situation Room was a deep and considered process, like a product of a process. And it wasn't, you know, this haphazard, let's make things happen fast, but not really understand the consequences of our actions. And President Obama always wanted to know cause and effect. Right. And so you can't really know cause and effect if you don't have all of the facts.
So another thing that you had to do as deputy chief of staff is work with agencies like the Department of Defense to run classified construction projects and maintain the continuity of government exercises, exercises so that if there's a nuclear attack or if Washington floods or the president is incapacitated, everyone knows what to do.
Exactly.
Just mentally, emotionally, what was it like for you to be in charge of planning for the absolute worst?
Oddly, it was actually very reassuring when you sit down with the folks who, again, from administration to administration, keep this process alive and have this information. You know, you sit down and they brief you and you're like, oh, wow. If something happens, actually, everybody does know what to do. And so I found it, on the one hand, it's very heady. You're like, I can't believe that I'm seeing what would happen if a nuclear missile was launched from X and how long it would take to get here and what happens. But it is comforting to see that these processes are pretty well socialized. Everybody knows them. You know, the 25th Amendment has been one of the funnier things that happens is you obviously notify the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader and Minority Leaders in Congress. And we realized that when we actually ran the exercise that all of the fax numbers were wrong because people didn't really use faxes anymore. So that was, we're like, oh, we should get new fax numbers. And you sort of do what's called validating the exercise. Every couple of years, if you haven't used it in real time, you sit down and you do what's called an exercise and you run through all the steps to make sure nothing's changed, the fax numbers are still there, and that the documents are still valid and don't need to be updated.
Can you tell us what your role was supposed to be in case of the worst, like where you would be and what your job would be?
Can't really talk about what my job would be, but in a scenario of the president being incapacitated, say he needed to have surgery, I sort of ran the process, the many steps of the 25th Amendment and sort of bringing that to life. And then in worst case scenario, if the president had to go someplace, I would have been part of the crew that was evacuated with him.
What was the closest you got to having to enact one of those plans?
Goodness. Oh, I would say it was when the president had his colonoscopy.
Wow, if that was the worst.
knock wood, yes, that is the worst I remember.
So you were preparing for, like, say it really doesn't go well? Or just for
yes.
that period when he's incapacitated because he's
just
under
a light
sedative?
Just for that period when he's exactly, and we figured this is a great time for us to, you know, go through all of the steps, and it was an interesting exercise.
Right. Okay.
you feel like you're in the West Wing television show, in those scenarios.
So tell us about Air Force One.
Air Force One and the White House Medical Office are the two things that you miss the most when you leave. People talk about, oh, it must be so not, you know, oh, Alyssa, like uptown problems. You always flew on Air Force One. I said, yeah, but now I have no frequent flyer miles anywhere, so I don't get upgraded. So it's doubly hard. But I will tell you, getting on Air Force One for the first time was the most humbling, awe-inspiring. You know, you are trying to be an adult, right? But you're literally a kid in a candy shop. You're like, can I take a tour? Can I go up and see where all the equipment is? It is a lot like you see on TV. And what people don't totally know, they're like, oh, you know, we would fly. President Obama liked to be very efficient with his time. So many, many trips, we would leave Washington at night, fly overnight, and then land in country the next morning around 8 o'clock and start our day. And people wouldn't understand there aren't like beds for us on Air Force One. We had those like Snuggies that you buy on QVC and we would sleep on the floor. And the best part of becoming deputy chief, especially when Valerie Jarrett didn't travel, is that I could claim the couch. There was one couch that you could sleep on. And And then you'd get up and everybody shares two bathrooms. So you get up, everyone's brushing their teeth, washing their face, and there's a line for the bathroom. And Valerie and I were always quick to be the first two to wake up so that we would sort of have the bathroom in a fresh state. And then you get ready and you have your breakfast and you go down and you start your day. And there is nothing like walking off the steps of Air Force One. Every single time, you never don't feel proud. You always feel so proud. And I think that we were just always, the reception too of other people in countries when they see that beautiful blue and white plane, it's just, it always gives you goosebumps.
You had to sleep on the floor?
Yeah, we would sleep on the floor. The seats didn't recline all the way, so they could be really uncomfortable. And so we would, a lot of us would sleep on the floor.
Wow.
See, it's not that glamorous.
No, really. So, but now you have to fly coach?
I do.
What a come down.
I know, it's a real bummer when you're in like boarding group D.
So what was the worst fiasco that you were involved with? This is assuming there was a fiasco.
Well, this one's sort of funny. It wasn't quite a fiasco, but there was this period of time, I think it was in 2011, when that Icelandic volcano erupted and caused that plume that sort of circled the globe and was quite dangerous for planes, because if you flew through the plume, it would melt the engines and the plane would crash. And so we had several trips at that time that were scheduled, foreign trips. One was, you'll recall, I think it was the president of Poland was killed in a plane crash, and the funeral was happening, and we couldn't go because of the plume. But then a couple weeks later, we had to go to Asia, and we were in, I think we were in Indonesia, and we were at a summit, and I got a report from the military aide that the plume was coming dangerously close, and that if we didn't take off in like the next 2 hours, we were going to be stuck in Jakarta. And so I got on the phone with the mil aide and the captain for Air Force One, and as president, when the first time President Obama met Colonel Turner, he said, "That's exactly what I want my my pilot to look like," because he looked like a total badass with his buzzed hair and he was really tough. But I found Colonel Turner. I said, "You know, what are we going to do? We have to get out of here. We can't be stuck in Jakarta." And he said, "Well, the best thing for us to do is be number one in line for takeoff." And he said, "But the Chinese are pulling their plane, they're taxiing the plane out." And so I sort of had to make this decision, and I told him to cut the Chinese off and pull out Air Force One and get us first in line for takeoff. And we had to hurry to the plane, and the president and all of the military folks on the plane were like, "Oh, this is great, we're taking off, and you know, we could have been stuck here for 3 days." And the president's like, "Well, what do you mean?" They're like, "Well, if we hadn't been the first in line to take off, we would probably be stuck. We couldn't get back to the U.S. And he said, "Well, how did we get first in line for takeoff?" And they said, "Alyssa told us to cut off the Chinese." And he looked at me like I could potentially have done something very bad, but at the same time was very glad because we all wanted to go home.
This could have started a conflict with the Chinese.
It could have.
Because of American arrogance.
Exactly.
Well, it's a huge responsibility to, you know,
yes.
You can't be flying with the president if it's dangerous and the plane might go down, right?
I mean, that would be bad.
Yeah,
that would really be bad. Because as he would remind us, if that ever happened, it would be President Barack Obama and several unnamed staffers. We were like, we know.
Does work at the White House stop on weekends?
No. You know, of course, having, you know, we had Blackberries back then, but we usually at least a couple times a month had a scheduled Saturday sort of planning meeting. And it was very casual. You could come in jeans or, you know, workout clothes, and we would sit down and go over things. But you always had to be available. And I, when I became deputy chief of staff, got a secure communication system that was in my bedroom. Made it quite warm because there's an actual server next to your bed. My apartment was not that big. But you could always be reached sometimes, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, the red phone rings and it's the Situation Room and something's happened. And they would call me and say, you know, "Should we alert the chief of staff next or should we go straight to the president?" And I would say, you know, go straight to the president, you know, or simultaneous, you know, notify them simultaneously. But no, I could never say that I was off ever.
So you were under a lot of stress in your position at the White House. Most people at work, you can always say to yourself, well, it's just a radio show, or it's just a whatever. You can't say, well, it's just the security of the United States of America. It's just the president of the United States. I mean,
correct.
Everything is at stake here. So talk a little bit about the level of stress and how you tried to deal with it.
So the stress, there are two things. You know, you can manage the stress until, because you, there's so much adrenaline. You know, I think I basically ran on adrenaline almost for 6 years. But eventually it all starts catching up with you, right? Like you can sort of, you can manage the stress. I think we were all pretty good at it. But it's that you never have sort of a down cycle to recover. And so if you, if I was planning a foreign trip, and a lot of times when you'd be planning a foreign trip, you're working on a completely different time zone for at least a week before you leave. And then you come back and there's no vacation, there's no days off. You know, you're back in the office the next day. And so ultimately, I think it was the sleep that caught up and maybe had me not deal with the stress as well as I could have. But by about the end of 2012, I was in my office with David Plouffe, and I was typing while I was talking to him because I can do that. And he said, Alyssa, what are you doing? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, none of the words on your computer screen are words. And I looked, and it was just like gibberish, basically. And I realized that that I wasn't quite right, that something was off. I thought about it. I had been forgetting things a lot lately, like not big things, but the things that are easy, like I'm in the car halfway to work and I couldn't remember if I had fed my cat. And it turned out they gave me a gross neurological exam that I was basically functioning sort of on like 50% of my capacity and that I was very sleep deprived. And so that was actually when they said, look, you know, you've got to start going to bed at 10. You've got to take an Ambien. You have to get some real sleep, not just be in bed, but like go to sleep. And after about 3 weeks, I took the test again and I was up to like 85%. And so, you know, I was on the right track, but it was a sign that, you know, I was probably coming to the end of my time and that I was so lucky to have had such incredible experiences. But, you know, maybe it was time for someone with fresh legs to take over and have the same experiences that I did. And for all of the things that I would pride myself on, I normally have a good attitude. I'm sort of decent, fun enough to be around. And I prided myself on being creative and being an idea machine. And, you know, my ideas just weren't, they weren't flowing. It was, I was becoming the person who sat at the table. And when someone had an idea, I'd be the one who said, we did that, it didn't work. We did that in 2011. It was like I had too much memory. I'd been there too long. And so I decided that it was time for me to go because I wanted to leave on a high note. I never wanted to be that person that people are secretly meeting about how to get them to realize their time has come so that they go. And so I was glad to sort of decide on my own terms that it was time to go. And it was a really nice send-off. And the best way to leave is to have your replacement in line. And I knew that I thought that Anita Decker Breckenridge, who I'd known for many years and who had worked for Obama for many years, would be a great replacement. And so it was a pretty smooth transition.
Okay. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I loved it.
Alyssa Mastromonaco is President Obama's former Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations at the White House and author of the new book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? Film critic Justin Chang has a review of a new movie by British writer and director Terence Davies, who has often told stories about women trapped in the rigid customs of an earlier era, including The House of Mirth, The Deep Blue Sea, and Sunset Song. Davies' new film, A Quiet Passion, is about the poet Emily Dickinson.
A Quiet Passion begins with a young Emily Dickinson being kicked out of Mount Holyoke College, a Christian women's university, for her unorthodox religious views. It is not the last time this great American poet will be mischaracterized by minds and doctrines far feebler than her own. If Dickinson questioned God, the movie suggests, it was because she knew that he had given her the spirit and the intellect with which to do so. Certainly she has no interest in answering to mere mortals. In this scene, Emily, played by Cynthia Nixon, argues with a pastor, played by Miles Richardson, who takes her to task for her insufficient piety.
And you, Miss Dickinson, what of you? What of me, sir?
Will you not kneel and give yourself to God?
No, sir, I will not kneel. Though I think that God has already given himself to me.
That was profane.
It was not meant so, sir.
Do you guard your soul, Emily?
As best as I am able, sir.
And hell? What of hell?
Avoid it if I can. Endure it if I must.
That was irreligious, young lady.
Then I beg God's pardon for my impiety.
Nixon gives a brilliant performance of steely wit, but also surprising vulnerability. As she moves through the sunny gardens and lamplit drawing rooms of 19th century Amherst, Massachusetts, Nixon's Emily rebukes every reductive image we have of her as a dour, reclusive spinster. She is, on the contrary, a brilliant conversationalist and a lover of good company. She is also a gifted poet, who spends the wee hours of the morning lost in her writing, making what will one day be hailed as a monumental contribution to American literature. She does this with the permission of her father, played by Keith Carradine, who is both enchanted and exasperated by his daughter's razor-sharp mind and ungovernable spirit. The scenes of the Dickinsons together at home, beautifully filmed by the cinematographer Florian Hofmeister, are a delight, even the ones that roil with tension. You understand that this is a household where both religious devotion and intellectual freedom have been nurtured and allowed to coexist. Written and directed by the British filmmaker Terence Davies, A Quiet Passion creates an inner world that, for all its rigid social and personal constraints, feels alive with the possibilities of language. The formal dialogue, with its stately, mannered rhythms, becomes a kind of music. Simply listening to it can be bewildering at first, then absorbing, then transfixing. Its purpose, in line with the highest ideals of poetry itself, is to clear the mind and stir the soul. If that sounds a bit austere, rest assured that Davies also wants to make you laugh. The movie's first half is a riotous assemblage of drawing room banter to rival last year's Jane Austen comedy, Love and Friendship. Emily occasionally butts heads with her brother, Austen, played by Duncan Duff, and enjoys the close companionship of her sister, Vinny, played by Jennifer L. But in the movie's second half, Emily greets a series of difficult personal losses, including the departure of cherished friends and the deaths of her parents. The tonal register constricts, the rooms darken, and the story edges almost imperceptibly toward tragedy as Emily makes her slow and steady march toward solitude, illness, and death. A Quiet Passion beautifully marries two strains in Davies' earlier films. His semi-autobiographical masterworks, Distant Voices, Still Lives, and The Long Day Closes, captured the visual and emotional texture of domestic life, while his later literary adaptations, most notably his magnificent 2000 film, The House of Mirth, have revealed him to be an unusually sharp, sensitive portraitist of women. Indeed, there is something of Edith Wharton in Davies' conception of Emily Dickinson as a woman tragically ahead of her moment, and also in Nixon's performance, a tour de force of impeccable diction and raw, unruly feeling. At times, Emily's tears flow as freely as her words, and you feel the wrenching tension between her deep understanding of the world's imperfection and her search for the words that would capture it perfectly. In these moments, the film's pursuit of a higher form of artistic truth merges beautifully with Dickinson's own.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. My guest bears some responsibility for getting the expression F-bomb in the dictionary, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, which is to say, Corey Stamper's job as a lexicographer and associate editor at Merriam-Webster isn't about policing the language, it's about monitoring the changing ways we use language so that she can add new words and modify the definition and usage of old ones. She's written a new book called Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. Corey Stamper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
So how does a new word get added to the dictionary? What's the criteria?
So there are three criteria for entry. The first is widespread use, which means a word needs to be used all over the place in all sorts of different kinds of places. So if a word is used in Vibe magazine and in the Wall Street Journal, that's widespread use. Or if a word is used in California and then it's used in South Africa, that's widespread use. So that's the first criterion. The second is sustained use. So a word needs to actually have kind of a long shelf life. because most words come into the language and either don't have much written use for a long time, or they have a lot of written use and then they drop out of use for 10 or 20 years. So we like to see some sustained usage to make sure that it's sort of settled into the language. And then the third criterion is meaningful use, which means that the word has to have a meaning, which sounds patently ridiculous. But there are a handful of words that show up in print that just don't have a lexical meaning.
So are you the lexicographer responsible for getting the word F-bomb in the dictionary?
I think that it was one that I had proposed, and I don't know that I ended up drafting the final entry for that.
Why did you propose it?
Because it's been in use a lot, and I think that I decided to propose it for entry. What was I reading? I was reading, it might have been something like First Things or Commonweal, some sort of very stately, staid, scholarly kind of religious magazine, and it used the word F-bomb, and I just thought, okay, if Commonweal or First Things is using the word F-bomb, then it's clearly settled in deeply enough. It's not just something that you're going to hear on, you know, The Daily Show or on NBC, Good Morning America, or whatever. So
I'm going to read the citation.
Okay.
Without saying what the word is that
okay.
It's being used in substitution for. So the definition reads that the F-bomb is the F word used metaphorically as a euphemism, except they spell out what the F word is in the,
right.
in the dictionary.
Right.
So, and then there's an example of its usage. And that example is accidentally dropped an F-bomb on television. And it names the person who wrote that sentence or mm-hmm. who said that sentence. Why is it important in a lot of entries to have an example that's not an example that the lexicographer came up with, but an example of how it's been used in speech or in a text?
I think it's important because, first, you need to have some evidence, maybe, that this word is in use. Because you do get people who will come to the dictionary and look up a word and say, I've never heard that word before. Or, blah, that's not a good word. That's not a valid word. That shouldn't be in the dictionary. And so part of it is to show that it actually does have use. But also, the other thing is that sometimes you need to show a word as it's used sort of in the wild. And if you can find a really good citation that does that, it's helpful because the way that we learn language is through context. Language isn't in these little discrete boxes like we present it in the dictionary. You don't have a word that just exists on its own with no context around it. So context is always really important, I think. The more context you can give someone, the better.
So the first known use of the F-bomb, according to the Merriam-Webster, was in 1988. How do you find out something like that?
It's kind of a wild lexical goose chase. So one of the things that we do is we will find first dates of written use first by going through our own in-house citation database, and sometimes we have that citation there. Other times what we have to do is we have to start scouring other kinds of databases for the use. And honestly, now that things are online, it's so much easier to do. So you can go to a big database like LexisNexis and do a search for F-bomb that's targeted between certain dates. Sometimes we find the first written use by someone has mailed us a citation, or someone has written in and said, did you know that, in fact, I think F-bomb was first used by Gary Carter, who was a baseball player who was not known for swearing, but dropped the F-bomb once, and that made enough news that they needed a way to say what word he used, and so they came up with F-bomb. So finding these citations of first written use is really kind of, it's needle in a haystack. It just depends on what you have access to and sort of how far back you can take things. And new stuff is always coming to light. One thing that I found last year, I was looking for the word staycation, and I was doing some research.
Yeah.
I was doing some research on staycation, which is a word that many people think is frivolous and dumb, and sort of when we entered it into the dictionary, we got a lot of think pieces about this is indicative of our modern culture, that we can't just, bite the bullet and not take a vacation, that even when we are at home, we have to call it a staycation because we're pampered and spoiled. And that was based on a lot of the use that we had, which showed it was used mostly in the 90s. And then I happened to be doing some research in a historical newspaper database, and I found staycation dated back to 1944, where it was used in a beer ad of all places. And staycation was presented as something you did as your patriotic duty to help preserve money. It was like having a victory garden. So that's
fascinating.
Yeah. So it was really fun to find. And that happens all the time when you're finding the dates of first written use. You might think, oh, well, we've pegged it pretty much to the second half of the 20th century. And then you run across these random little things in a historical archive somewhere.
I use the word staycation a lot when I decide to take a week and just like stay home and just like not
right,
not be on deadline and just be around.
Yeah.
Maybe even see a friend.
Yeah. It's a handy word.
It's a great word. Yeah. I love that word. So I'm going to ask you about the word that Merriam-Webster says now ranks as almost certainly the most offensive and inflammatory racial slur in English, a term expressive of hatred and bigotry, and that's the N-word. Mm-hmm. I won't say the word. And you have a good blog post about this word. Did you have to work on this word ever?
I had to look at the word for revision at one point a while ago. It was for a different dictionary for people who are learning English as a foreign language. And I was looking at it sort of as a second pass. So I was taking a look at it as a copy editor would have taken a look at it.
So let me read the official Merriam-Webster definition, and then we'll talk about it. One, offensive. See usage paragraph below. Used as an insulting and contemptuous term for a black person. Two, offensive. Used as an insulting and contemptuous term for a member of any dark-skinned race. Three, now often offensive. A member of a class or group of people who are systematically subjected to discrimination and unfair treatment. And the example is, it's time for somebody to lead all of America's N-words, all the people who feel left out of the political process. And that sentence is attributed to Ron Dellums. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the things that makes that word so complicated is that, in part because of rap, where the word is used frequently and often has become used as a word of almost affection that one black person can use to describe another. Mm-hmm. It's a word that's really so dependent on who's using it and what their intent is. So as a lexicographer, is that something you can deal with in the definitions or not? Like, how do you deal with that?
Within definitions, it's almost impossible to deal with that. Again, because we deal with print, and we're presenting information in writing. And that means that it's really difficult to give an exhaustive history of the word, of all of its various uses, of all of the ways it's been used as a slur, of all the ways it's been reclaimed. One thing we can do now that dictionaries are online is we can add these long usage paragraphs. And that's how we've chosen to discuss the history of the word. And even in that usage paragraph, we don't give all of the information that we could. This is a word that people have written books about. This is a word that you could do a book-length treatment of. And it's a word that is, it's not just fraught for lexicographers. It's fraught for everybody. There are debates within the African-American community about whether the word should be used or not. There are debates among people outside of the African-American community about whether this should be used or not. There are debates among various people of dark-skinned ethnicity groups or races about whether the word as applied to them is a sort of a valid slur, whether they're able to reclaim it. And this all gets down to intention and being in the middle of some of the most painful interactions that people have lexically. And that's just something that lexicographers have a really hard time doing. I mean, in part because we tend to be very introverted and shy people. We tend not to like being in the middle of any interaction if we can help it. But this interaction in particular, the interaction wherein a word is used to either dehumanize or rehumanize somebody is just it's a core response. And when you're tracking the word, you also have to take into account everything that goes underneath of that. And it's almost impossible to put that in writing.
You got a letter from, or an email, mm-hmm. from a dictionary reader who was upset to find that word in the dictionary, mm-hmm. and wrote to you, "I understand why you put it there, but I'm thinking of my 10-year-old daughter. The N-word shouldn't exist for her. She should not have to confront that in a dictionary, which is supposed to tell her what words really mean." Mm-hmm. So what's your response to that?
When I got that email, it literally knocked the breath out of me, because I also have children, and I also think, you know, there are lots of words in the world that I don't ever want leveled at my kids or want my kids using. There are lots of words that I wish didn't exist at all. And to see that kind of pain just stated so plainly and very eloquently was really affecting. And so I had to stop and think, okay, well, I'm a parent, but I'm also a lexicographer. And I have to say, you know, here's the thing. This is what this word actually means. And just because it's in the dictionary doesn't mean that we are promoting its use. It's a word that I myself would never use. And yet, my job is to record the language. And this word has just sort of cut this wide swath through the language. For me to not include it would not get rid of the word's use at all. You know, some people think, well, if we do away with the slurs in the dictionary, then no one will ever learn them, which is a great sentiment, but just not how language works. I mean, I chuckle sometimes when parents write in and say, "I can't believe you've included profanity in the dictionary. Now my children will discover what, you know, the F word means." And my first thought is, your kid already knows what the F word means. They're looking it up in the dictionary. It's to see if it's entered, not because they don't know what it means.
So you have two children?
I have two children.
When they were learning language,
mm-hmm.
And then when they got a little older and started to use more like vernacular language, mm-hmm. more slang, did you try to correct them? Or I know you don't like to police people's language, and you don't edit your children's social media, but you know, what rules did you try to uphold when they were speaking to you in the house?
Oh boy. Even though I say I don't police people's speech, I am a mom, and moms police their children's speech because that's what moms do.
Also how people learn, how children learn. Right.
This is part of how kids learn, is you learn, okay, you don't say, you know, "I done that." You say, "I have done that." Oh, okay. I would do that, and I don't anymore. My children are older. But earlier, for instance, I live outside of Philadelphia, and I had a hard time when we moved because my youngest daughter picked up a regionalism that's very common here and I had never heard before, and that is to drop the particle after done. So I would say, "Are you finished with your homework?" And she would say, "Yeah, I'm done my homework," which to me just sounds as foreign as outer space. You're done with your homework. You're not done your homework. But that's this really distinctive dialect marker for this region. And it's said by everybody of all socioeconomic brackets and all educational brackets. And so for her, that was completely normal. And it drove me bonkers. I would keep saying, "You're done with, you're done with, you're done with." And she still says, "I'm done my homework." And she has learned that if she's speaking to her grandparents who are not natives of this area, she has to say, "I'm done with my homework." So yeah, I mean, you know, that urge to correct people dies hard, especially when they're your own kids.
So do you feel like as a parent and lexicographer, you're seeing how language changes generationally by listening to your own children?
Oh, absolutely. My youngest daughter just turned 17, and I'm the carpool mom for one of her activities. And what I will do is I will wait until all the teenagers get in the car and they get talking and they have sort of, you know, done the first 5 minutes of being used to being in the car with mom. And then I will listen to the language that they use, the slang that they use. And as their season progressed, I got more and more comfortable with interrupting them and saying, wait a minute, what's that mean? Or, ooh, what do you, oh, so you say, you know, She was nasty AF instead of AF. Is that how you say it? You say AF? You don't say AF?
AF.
AF as F word.
Oh. And right.
Yeah.
Got it.
Also AF. Which, so I do. I get to watch how quickly the cycle of language changes, not just slang, but even the ways that we communicate with each other. You know, lots of people sort of throw their hands up in dismay and say, oh, kids these days, they're always on their phone, they can't have a conversation. And I'm happy to say that's absolutely not true. I can sit in a car with kids and they have conversations and they use language that is vibrant and interesting, and they use standard English just fine too.
Corey Stamper, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry. This has been great.
Corey Stamper is an associate editor at Merriam-Webster and author of the new book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.